on a 220 to 215 vote, including the support of one Republican, Mr. Joseph Cao, C-A-U, from Louisiana, and opposition from 39 Democrats. You best believe their names are on a list lots of places. The House of Representatives backed a bill late on Saturday that will expand coverage to nearly all Americans and bar insurance practices such as refusing to cover people with pre-existing medical conditions. However, just a minor detail, it also throws women over the side, according to all kinds of women's rights and reproductive rights organizations. The National Organization for Women held a rally on Monday in opposition to the Stupak amendment slipped in by Representative Bart Stupak, who held Mr. Pelosi and Mrs. Pelosi and the bill hostage until she agreed to put language in which would, according to most analysts, forbid abortion rights to anybody who has anything to do with any federal money, including this new public option plan. It's a very scary prospect, and as you might imagine, that has caused all kinds of folks to say they are not supporting it. Meanwhile, we have Big Pharma coming out today. The CEO of one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies, which is AstraZeneca, David Brennan, the head, told Huffington Post that he was very happy with the White House and the Senate Finance Committee versions of health care, but he was not about to go around and support the House bill because the House is not played by the rules that the White House set up with Big Pharma, which was that the Big Pharma would contribute $80 billion to reform in exchange for various assurances, primarily that the government would not use its purchasing power to negotiate cheaper prescription drug prices. And that's what this story seems to be about right now, is what kind of deals do you make for what end? Do you cut off your nose to spite your face? Lots of progressives are saying, let's stop funding these Democrats. Tell them that we're not going to stand for it anymore. Very angry women are saying just that. Or do we hold our noses, which we're very familiar with, and go along because this bill is better than nothing? To discuss this topic, we have joining us on the telephone, as usual, my co-producer, really, Ellen Schaefer, who is co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis in San Francisco. Good afternoon to you, Ellen.
Hi there, Chris.
Also, Darcy Berner rejoins us. She's executive director of the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation. You can go to www.progressivecongress.org to see what they're up to. Hi, Darcy.
Hi.
And I think we have Susan Wood on the phone as well. She's associate professor and director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. And you'll recall that she was the woman who resigned from the FDA, where she was head of women's health during the Bush administration, because the Bush administration overrode the FDA advisory committee advice on providing a morning after pill for younger women. And when Bush administration said, oh, heck no, Susan said, yeah, well, same to you, I'm out of here. And she now joins us on the phone. Good afternoon to you, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure to have you here. So let's cut right to the chase and talk about whether women's groups that are talking about this is it, I'm so done, it's so over between me and the Democrats, bleep all of them, I hope they all lose in 2010, and better no bill at all than this one with the Stupak amendment. Who wants to start with that? Ellen, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't know about the no bill. You know, that there are maybe two separate discussions. I don't know about no bill at all, and that's something that people can argue about. But certainly, you know, progressives have really kept this bill alive and kept it affordable and kept the public option in it. And I think, you know, what we really need to do is redouble our efforts, you know, for people who don't like this bill. Anyway, that's fair, and people can argue about whether it's affordable enough and whether we'd be better off with a single payer, and we could get that now. I don't think we can, and I think there's a lot of good stuff in here which we can talk about in terms of expanding access and making it more affordable, but we shouldn't have to choose. I mean, it really came down to a question of about 10 votes, as I understand it, and a vote that was 215 to 220, and I think we have to make sure that this doesn't play out again on the Senate side, and that when it comes back to conference, you know, the Democratic leadership does two things, find something else to bargain over, and exert more leadership. And if that means, I don't think we want to hand the reins back to the reactionary right wing. We've had a couple of years of that, but maybe we need to be electing some better Democrats.
Yeah, I would agree that we shouldn't allow either health care reform to be held hostage to abortion politics, and it was certainly the other side that turned this into this kind of battle. But at the same time, we shouldn't let abortion rights be held hostage to health care reform. I think during the first, the thinking by thinking people was that for the abortion issue that and for the women's health provisions that this would be abortion neutral. This was not a place for either gains or losses, much as there are problems with access and the Hyde Amendment and so forth. But everyone thought that the best way to succeed in health care reform was to be abortion neutral. And unfortunately, at the last minute, the bishops and anti-abortion folk did hold health care reform hostage in a way that was so outrageous that we ended up with this amendment, and it's now going to take every single senator that we have, one has to stand up and be ready to be counted, and not to allow this to turn into a false choice, but rather one where we take it back to being abortion neutral and fight those battles later.
This is Darcy. What, that was Darcy, right?
No, that was Susan.
Sorry. Okay, good. Sorry.
That was Susan.
Okay. And Susan is at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Well, you said it's going to take every senator that we have, and of course, it's such a question, which ones we have and which ones we don't have, and how do we have them after all, since Lieberman, who is counted as a Democrat, even though he's an independent, has already said, you can forget my vote if there's anything like a public option in it.
Well, he has said that a couple of times in a couple of different ways, and he's actually been moved on that.
No kidding.
He's softened a bit. And actually, there are two people in jail who are fasting until he meets with them in Connecticut, who are running a fasting campaign, Kai Newkirk and John Moorbacher. So I'd say there's will be increasing pressure on Senator Lieberman.
In fact, there have been demonstrations in his office, people
absolutely
arrested. There have been all kinds of things. And all over the blogosphere, there's get this guy out of here. What does it take?
Yep.
And but also senators like Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer, even though, you know, you can say, well, we don't have to worry about them where we live, their votes are fine. They need to have the support of their communities, as does Nancy Pelosi, to say, stand firm. We're behind you. Keep moving forward. Do not step back. And they need that because every single vote counts,
okay,
not just the.
And that's Susan again. Darcy, did you want to get in here?
I do.
The
Senate is obviously incredibly important, and we have to make sure that the bill the Senate sends into conference doesn't contain STUPAC-like language. But to be perfectly honest, our work in the House isn't done. One of the questions that they'll be considering in the conference committee is how they get 218 votes for the conference report when they bring it back to the House of Representatives. The only way that they could get to 218 this time around seem to be to throw women under the bus. And there's an enormous amount of work that needs to be done on the set of Democrats who voted no on the STUPAC amendment, that is, they voted correctly on that, but then who voted no on the health care bill, because unless we can flip some of them to yeses, we're not going to get the conference report we want. And the way that the STUPAC amendment was written, it's not just women who get federal funding that this is going to affect. Because of the way it was written, it's likely that anybody who gets their health insurance through the exchange or through the public option will not be able to have coverage for abortion, even when you have catastrophically bad things happen in the pregnancy, even when you have really severe fetal abnormalities.
And so even when you're putting up your own money, for that bloody sake.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing that the people who are defending the, you know, that this is being not important keep saying is, oh, well, abortions only cost $300 or $400 a piece. It's not that a good deal. You tell that to a woman who finds out at 18 weeks that her fetus is anencephalic, and she can't get the medical care that she and her doctor need, which is thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, because Bart Stupak says that constitutes an abortion that isn't going to be covered, even though it's the medically correct thing to do.
And that's Darcy Berner, director, executive director of the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation. And once again, you can find them at www.progressivecongress.org. And I'm noticing, speaking of progressives, that Move On is has launched a petition to Evan Bayh, Mary Landrieu, Blanche Lincoln, Ben Nelson about... if they do what they, if they try to stop healthcare from going to an up or down vote, this is about the
filibuster.
Yeah, filibuster culture vote. And then there's another effort being launched on the House, as Darcy, you just mentioned, was part of it too. And Daily Kos has been urging readers to simply stop writing checks to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, saying it's too bad that this might hurt some good people, but this is, you know, the only place they pay attention. Even the AFL-CIO is starting to discuss whether or not they should withhold contributions if they oppose this cloture vote, the filibuster thing in the Senate. Let's focus on that end of it for a while, just the sort of sticky details of process within the Senate, because as both Susan and Darcy have mentioned, we've got this House vote now, but now it goes to the Senate, and then it will bring a Senate version and the House version to the conference committee, and then everybody will have to vote on that. Lots of folks are saying, let's have a debate on the floor, for God's sake, and let's really hash it out, and let folks who don't like this bring up an amendment of their own, since that hasn't really been very prominent. No one has anything to say except, we don't like this. But it looks like anybody, you don't even have to hold a filibuster. All you have to say is, I'm going to, and then everybody starts kissing your butt. I don't get that part. What's happened to democracy? Someone answer me.
What do you think, Darcy?
Well, I mean, I think that there is a real problem in the Senate with filibuster. I think, to be perfectly honest, Harry Reid needs to decide that doing the work of the American people is more important than being nice to his colleagues. And until he decides that that's the case, until he actually stands up and says, the Senate has work to get done, they owe it to the American people, and they're not going to allow stupid procedural, completely unnecessary obstacles to get in the way of that, then we're going to see this kind of foot-dragging there. I mean, they have to decide the American people are more important than who they go have coffee with.
And again, this is Ellen. I just want to add that until people started really leaning on Harry Reid and making a fuss in the Senate generally, we weren't hearing anything about a public option on the Senate side, which now we seem to be hearing about. So I think pressure from the public has made a difference, and it is time to re-triple it.
Now, what about the fears that, as some have already said, gosh, I think we'll want one of those abortion amendments over on our side, too. Lots of folks say, don't worry about it. The Senate is much more pro-choice than the House. It's not going to happen. But Harry Reid himself is not pro-choice. How much should we be worrying about that particular end of it?
Well, I mean, it is true that the Senate is more pro-choice than the House, in part because the choice advocacy organizations have been focusing so much of their energy on the Senate, and frankly, comparatively little of it on the House. We do not have a pro-choice majority in the House of Representatives, which is a huge problem, obviously. But that being said, even with a pro-choice majority in the Senate, I don't think we can afford to sit back and relax. There is a kind of doomsday scenario, which is if the Senate were, in fact, to pass something that included Stupak-like language, anything where the House bill and the Senate bill are the same, the conference committee can't change. And at that point, we have women dying because they can't get the medical care they need with the health insurance plans they're paying for.
Mm-hmm. Because
this is Susan. I would absolutely agree. It's a critical thing to keep the heat on. I mean, we have to work sort of a three-way strategy, as was mentioned. We have to work with the Senate on at every step in every way we can, keeping the larger grassroots progressive movement focused on both health care reform and making sure women are the losers. We have to be working on the House side because it is going to come back to the House, and every single vote there counts. And then we have to have a White House strategy as well, because the key strategy that we seem to see working is that President Obama promised from the campaign forward that people would not lose the health care that they already have covered. They are there, if they like their insurance, they could keep it. Well, with this new proposal, women would lose coverage that they had before in their health insurance plan. There's no question, and anyone who asserts differently, you know, is either deliberately or not stating falsely. And that argument that women should not be losing coverage that they already had. And they're the only ones who would be losing. Young women would be the only ones losing benefits. That point needs to be brought home at all levels, but particularly to the White House, to make sure they stand up and the president stands up for this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ellen, go ahead.
This is Ellen Schaefer. I just want to emphasize what a loss this would be, because I know you want to talk some about the mechanics and the politics in Congress, but I'm starting to see articles and hearing from folks saying, well, you know, not really so bad and not so many people. And after all, we already have the Hyde Amendment, which says, you know, only federal dollars for rape, incest, or life of the mother. And then it turns out, gee, sometime in the 1990s, we lost the right to use federal dollars for federal employees. So the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan no longer covers abortion. And I think we need to look at this as an ongoing war of attrition, in which this is a major step backwards. I mean, just going from saying federal dollars can pay for abortion to saying anybody in these health exchanges, and it's important to be real clear about this, anybody in the health exchanges, not just the public option, whether you're using private money or whether you get subsidies or you don't, no one is going to be allowed to buy a plan that covers abortion. And if we don't think that's going to further roll back the number of providers who are trained to provide abortion, who will make it available and accessible, it's absolutely going to have that effect. And we need to recognize this for the turning point that it really is.
And women's rights, women. No, go ahead. You were going to say something. This is Darcy?
Yeah, this is Darcy.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to add on to what Ellen said. I agree that there is a tendency by a lot of people to minimize the importance of this. This is a huge step backwards. And to be perfectly honest, Hyde isn't acceptable as a line.
Absolutely. Amen.
Yeah.
The fact that the health of the mother isn't a factor is an enormous problem. I mean, if you have a woman who, you know, 4 months along is diagnosed with leukemia and is faced with a choice between continuing her pregnancy or getting the treatment she needs, the Hyde standard says if she'll survive the pregnancy, she doesn't get a choice, even if it means she dies 3 months later.
Mm. Well, and this is again an example of what happens when you hold your nose and vote, because that the Hyde Amendment is now better than,
right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, this is
right.
I
mean, I think that's going back to the thought was the Hyde Amendment, we would say this is going to be an abortion-neutral bill so that we could get health care reform and focus on the other aspects and come back. And that was very difficult to do. That was a very difficult compromise to make. And then to go and lose further and turn it into an abortion fight where we're not fighting about getting rid of the Hyde Amendment, but we're fighting about losing even further is disturbing, to say the least.
Well, so this is the atmosphere within which all of us are working. You're listening on the telephone to, first of all, Ellen Schaefer, co-director at the Center for Policy Analysis. You can check them out at www.centerforpolicyanalysis.org, and she writes an excellent blog at http://ellenschaefer.blogspot.com, and that's S-H-A-F-F-E-R, ellenschaefer.blogspot.com. Also, Darcy Berner, executive director of American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, Foundation, and you can go to www.progressivecongress.org. And Susan Wood, who teaches at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, where she directs the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health. And she was formerly the director of the Women's Health Branch or whatever of the FDA under Mr. Bush, and she quit because Mr. Bush just went a little too far. And that's what we're looking at here, this system whereby at the very last minute some idiot can go in and say, nanny, 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 you have to do what I want or I'm taking my marbles and going home, and that's the end of the game.
And I think, Chris, this is Ellen, the trick for us is going to be for people who desperately want this bill to pass, and there are a lot of people who do, and that includes a lot of folks in the public and a lot of our political leaders, to take the approach that women ought to be furious about this, and what we need to do is turn women's fury into passing a progressive health care bill. I don't think that again, as we were starting to say in the beginning, I don't think that, I think some of the downplaying of the danger of this Stupak amendment comes from folks who think, well, gee, if we just kind of act like it's okay, maybe we're going to come out of this with a decent health care bill and we want it to pass. And I think the better approach is to think about how we can harness the energy that's really pouring out about this outrage and make sure that we use that to try to get a decent bill. You know, I read, and Darcy, I don't know if you saw, or Susan, if you saw this, or Chris, 8.2 million people downloaded H.R. 3962, the House version of the bill.
Wow.
Good luck to them reading it, you know.
Well, and their machines are probably still working downloading.
I mean, no doubt.
It's 2,000 pages.
Yeah, so I'd say there's some interest in this. I mean, some of them are lobbyists for the insurance industry, but not all of those people. And I think that there's a lot of folks who can be mobilized, and I don't know, maybe there's some people who are worried about that part too, but I think, you know, there's a much more progressive base out there who can fight with us so that we protect women's rights and also get a decent health care bill.
Amen. Well, let's talk about what was good, what we want to save in the House thing, and that'll maybe help strengthen us for the battle with the Senate. Ellen, you're sort of on top of that.
Well, we have a public option. We are going to have the opportunity for many more people, and it actually H.R. 3962 that the House voted on was better in a lot of ways than the original bill that came out of the House. Many more people are going to have the option to buy a plan through the health insurance exchange and then to choose the public option if they want to. It goes up to employees of 100 employees, small businesses, within a short period of time, and it's pretty clear that it's going to be very easy to expand that to large employers. So that's one thing that's different. There also are some limitations on excessive premiums that start. That's a mechanism that starts in 2010. People who have COBRA will be able to keep it until 2013, and also young people on their parents' plans will be able to keep that till the age of 27. So there's a lot more bridging and affordability measures for access between when the bill passes, which hopefully it will, and 2013 when these health exchanges and the public option go into effect. As before, the government can negotiate Medicare rates. There will be quality improvements. Employers for the first time will have to pay into health insurance, which has been always a failure of our system, that we have employment-based insurance but no requirement that employers pay in. And there is an individual mandate, which is a drawback. There are affordability protections, and those are stronger in the House version than in the Senate version. But given that we seem to be faced with getting something less than a single-payer program, what's come out of the House has been responsive to what progressives have been looking for, is much stronger, and is, again, by the standard we were talking about in terms of women's rights, it is better than what we have now.
And, of course, we've got Joe Lieberman saying, although you say he's softening his stance, which is good news, we've also got saying that he wouldn't vote for it if the public option was in it. We've got Bernie Sanders saying, I'm not going to vote for it if the public option isn't in it.
Uh-huh.
So,
So, more company for Bernie.
Yeah. Well,
and I think that Bernie's also going to offer I'm not sure, but one thing that didn't make it through in the House bill was the Kucinich Amendment, which would protect states from ERISA lawsuits in the case in that they chose to adopt a single-payer program, and I think there's some hope that Sanders will introduce that, and that's something that would be just great to have come out of the Senate, because then we can conference it and get it back in the bill.
We should say, Ellen Schaefer, who has worked very closely with Mr. Kucinich, Dennis was one of those 39 Democrats that voted against the final bill.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said, you know what, this is just further of the handing over of our nation's wealth and of all the people's money to Wall Street. There's nothing in here that changes the status quo about the insurance business getting all of this money. And so I'm not voting for it.
Yeah, well, you know, and certainly has a point. The insurance industry, which I believe now actually opposes the bill. I think they came out opposing the House bill.
Yes, Big Pharma and insurance came out against it, which means that I'm for it automatically.
There you go. But, you know, Dennis voted against it. Brian Barrett of Washington voted against it. Eric Massa voted against it. I don't know how many of those votes could turn around if there were something a little better in the bills, but isn't it worth trying to go for those votes instead of the anti-abortion votes? I mean, who knows what would happen if we got a little more progressive spine from our members of Congress.
So that's Ellen Schaefer at the Center for Policy Analysis. Darcy, let me turn to you at the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation. How can we plug into whatever your strategies are here going forward?
Well, the key things that need to happen are pressure on the Senate to make sure that the bill that passes through the Senate is a good one. So both in terms of a public option, the affordability credits, and obviously in terms of making sure that women can get all of the health care that they need, not just the things that Burt's Dupac thinks are okay. But in addition to that pressure on the Senate side, there really does need to be a redoubled effort on the House, both to pressure the people who voted yes on the bill and yes on the Stupak amendment to be willing to move off of that position, and, as Ellen mentioned, on members like Brian Baird, Eric Massa, Dennis Kucinich to say, look, if you need to be willing to vote for this bill because we're not going to keep all of the people who voted for Stupak, and we need both this first step in fixing this country's health care system and a way to do it that doesn't throw women under the bus.
Amen. All right. And then once again, for the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, you want to check in with them at www.progressivecongress.org. Susan Wood, you're arguably the one of us here that has had the most real experience with the government, as Molly Ivins would say. What do you think of the chances here, and how important is public pressure?
Oh, I always think public pressure can have enormous effect. Sometimes you think it's just, you know, the lobbyists inside Washington, but members both in the House and Senate listen to people back home. If there's a lot of outrage and a lot of communication, I learned of a website today that Emily's List has put out petitioning Senator Reid. It's a very simple one called StopStupak.com. But there's lots of efforts going on through all the organizations that everyone should really engage in. And first of all, make a call to your senators and next to your member of Congress and let them know what you think about this. And it does have an effect. It has to be, like I said, the strategy on the House side initially was to work with the system, everybody adding their voice, you know, bit by bit, but not to have a fight over abortion or reproductive rights. The women's health community thought we could focus on the comprehensive approach to women's health. But that now, because of what happened, everyone needs to be very vocal that this is not what we want, but we do want health care reform. And it can have an effect. I'm both an optimist and a pragmatist, but I'm also, from the experience I had with emergency contraception and finally getting FDA to change its position over time, that change came about because people raised their voices, and we need people to do that now.
Amen. I thank you so much, all of you, for joining us today. Susan Wood, who is associate professor at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, where she is the director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health. Darcy Berner, executive director of the American Progressive Caucus Policy Foundation, www.progressivecongress.org. And my partner in crime, Ellen Schaefer, the co-director and co-founder of the Center for Policy Analysis here in the Bay, centerforpolicyanalysis.org, and her blog at Ellen Schaefer, S-H-A-F-F-E-R, ellenschaefer.blogspot.com. We'll give you all kinds of really good information about this entire process. And Ellen, of course, will do it again soon.
We'll keep it right up every Friday, you bet.
All right.
We get it right. Thanks a lot.